with Knein Hor, a large family who made Aliyah. And I have an extremely warm spot in my heart for Abanim. I have an even warmer spot in my heart for Olim. And I certainly have a great deal of respect for anybody who's a member of the staff of the Jerusalem College for Adults. So let it be understood throughout that how I feel. There are differences of opinion on all sorts of issues. Differences of opinion do exist. And it happens to be that the very beauty and the well-being of Torah is served and expressed precisely through the give and take of different approaches. The most significant area of Hashgafa today about which there are differences of opinion is the area of Medinat Yisrael, Yom Ha'atzma'ut, and all sorts of things that flow from that. There's no difference of opinion about the significance of Torah, or Shabbos, or Kashrus, or motherhood, but there are very sharp differences with regard to the question of how we ought to view the events of the present day. To give a very balanced approach, presenting both sides of the question, I unabashedly and unashamedly admit to being squarely on one of those sides. And maybe the best interests of Torah are served by expressing forcefully one side of the question by one who lives it and breathes it daily, and by hearing the other side by one who lives it and breathes it. I suspect that sometimes the even-handed approach leaves one view at a disadvantage, and maybe even both views. It becomes parava. It's neither here nor there. There are basically three approaches. I think you spoke about the kinot and the tachanun approach to Yom Ha'atzma'ut, the halel approach to Yom Ha'atzma'ut, and his was the su'udah hagigit approach to Yom Ha'atzma'ut. I'm on the Hallel side, and I want to explain it. And let me make one thing very, very clear. I do not say kablu da'ati. I don't tell you you have to accept my view. All I say is shimu da'ati. Just listen. Just listen. One general introduction, and from there we can go further. The general introduction is I would like to learn with you the introduction of the Netziv to Sefer Bereshit. Ramatali Tzvi Yehuda, Berlin, Shivar Valashin, author of the set of Chumashim HaMegdavar and a number of other classics for him, says the following in his introduction to Sefer Bereshit. Quote, Zeh ha-sefer ha-nikra sefer Bereshit, this sefer that is called the Book of Bereshit, nikra b'fi ha-nevi'im, is called by the Nevi'im, the prophets call it sefer ha-yashar, the Book of the Righteous. So he asks, why is sefer Bereshit called sefer ha-yashar, the Book of the Righteous? V'ho'inyan. So he says, the reason for this is, v'nidba'er b'shirat ha-azinu. We have explained in the song of Ha'azinu at the end of Torah, on the pasuk that says, Hatsur tamim pa'alo, kichol derachav mishpat, eil emunah ve'ein avel tzadik v'yoshar hu. Hatsur tamim pa'alo, the rock, God, his work is perfect. Kichol derachav mishpat, because all of his ways are justice. Keil emunah, he is a God of faithfulness, ve'ein avel, and no iniquity, tzaddik v'yashar hu, just and right is he. The Netziv wants to explain what's the meaning of yashar. Why is Sefer Bereshit called yashar? Bilam refers to the avos as Yeshurim. What's the meaning of Yashar? V'ho'inyan, the Shevach Yashar, the praise, when you call God Yashar, or you call man Yashar, Ne'emar lahatzdik din ha-kabifarku b'kurban bayit sheni. This is said in order to justify the fact that God destroyed the second Beit HaMikdash. Shehayad dor ikesh u'petaltol. The generation of Bayit Sheni was a generation that was crooked and perverse. U'pirashnu, the Netziv says, and we explain, Shehayu tzadikim, they were righteous, v'chasidim, and they were pious, v'ameilei ha-Torah, and they toiled in Torah, ach lo hayu yisharim v'halichot olamim. They were not righteous in the way in which they conducted themselves in the world. Al kain, therefore, mipnei sinat chinam shebelivam, because of the unwarranted hate in their hearts, zed zed to one another, chashdu et mi sheraou shenoheg shelo gedaatam b'yirat Hashem shehu tzeduki v'apikoros. They suspected anybody whom they saw who did not conduct himself the way they did in areas of Yirat Hashem, anybody who did not conduct themselves in their way, they suspected them of being tzeduki and apikoros. Ubo al yidei zeh lidei shfichat damim b'derech haflaga. They came to the spilling of blood b'derech haflaga. When our rabbis say spilling of blood, they mean it in an exaggerated form, euphemistically. They didn't kill people. There wasn't blood flowing in the streets of Yerushalayim, but you can kill people with a word, too. Ulechol hara'ot she'ba'olam, and all the terrible things that can happen in the world resulted from this, ad she'chorav habayit, until the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. Al zeh hayat siduk hadin. That's why we justify God's conduct. Shakodesh Baruch Hu yashar hu, Hakodesh Baruch Hu is righteous. Ve'eino sovel tzadikim ke'elu. He cannot tolerate tzadikim such as these. He cannot tolerate tzadikim, though they are chasidim u'tumimim and amelei ha-Torah. But if somebody else has a different approach in Yirat Hashem, they accuse him of being apikoros and tzaduki, that kind of tzadik HaKadosh Baruch Hu cannot tolerate. Ela ba'ofin sheholchim b'derech ha-yashar. He tolerates tzadikim who go in the path of righteousness. V'gam b'halichot olam, and even in their conduct and their interrelationship with others, v'lo ba'akimut, and not in crooked and perverse ways. Afal gav shuru l'shem shamayim. Even if this crookedness and perverseness is for the sake of heaven, the zeg goren churban ha-briyah, because this brings about the destruction of creation, v'harisat yishuv olam, and the shattering of the ability of a community to exist. V'zeh hayah shevach ha'avot. Sefer Bereshit is called Sefer Hayashar because that was the way in which the avot were praised. Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov were yashar. Shel milvad shehayu tzadikim v'chasidim, aside from the fact that they were righteous and they were pious, v'o'adei Hashem v'open hayoter efshar, and they were lovers of God in the greatest way possible, they were also righteous. Hainu, that means shehit nagu im umot ha'olam, they conducted themselves with the nations of the world. Afilu over the alilim mechu'avim, even disgusting idolaters. Kemo shanu ro, even with them they conducted themselves with yashrus. As we see, how much Avraham Avinu was able to prostrate himself before God to pray for stone. Though he hated them and their king, the furthest extent of hatred, they were the antithesis of Avraham Avinu. Mikom Avraham, despite that, chafetz b'kiyumam, he wanted that they should exist. He prayed for them. The Netziv is saying, therefore, in his Hagdama, Churban Habayit was the result of the fact that while people were tzaddikim, chasidim, and amelei ha-Torah, but there was a feeling that there was only one way to serve God. And in the event that anybody expressed an opinion or conducted himself in a way other than theirs, in the performance of mitzvah, they already called them kofer apikores min. That's not yosha. There are different ways. There are different ways. And en hakadosh baruch hu sovel tzadikim ka'el, hakadosh baruch hu does not tolerate that kind of tzimtzum. There are different approaches, and different approaches can be valid. There can be elements of truth in all. There is no one opinion. Yirat Hashem and Derech Hashem, all sorts of ways in which we approach God. That is the introduction of the Netziv to Sefer Bereishit. That's the general introduction. But that having been said, we can proceed to the matter at hand. First, I want to touch upon a number of points that were made by Rabbi, while not directly germane to our discussion, but they affect and influence it. And remember, my main purpose is not to disagree, but to present my view. However, a number of points need to be clarified. Otherwise, they have the cumulative effect of trivializing Yom HaAtzma'ut, and some of the things that were said are said and repeated in other places, in different forms, but basically the same thing is said. I'll begin with El Alamein. El Alamein. One of the criteria for saying Hallel, the criteria is if people were saved from death to life. The question therefore was asked, El Alamein, the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael was saved, and no Yontif was made of El Alamein. So therefore, Yom HaAtzma'ut is not El Alamein. I believe that point was made in both shiurim. The question was asked in the first shiur. I never heard an answer to the question of El Alamein, and finally I heard the question in the second shiur. What is the story with El Alamein? I'll tell you what the story with El Alamein is. In 1942, and I say this is going to be important not only for El Alamein, but the El Alamein question is repeated in different forms and in different ways. In 1942, Rommel had conquered all of North Africa. Churchill wrote that in the first 6 months of 1942, almost everything went disastrously wrong for the Allies. There were catastrophes in the Pacific, in the Atlantic, and in Russia, a defeat in the English Channel, and the prospect of another now in Malta. Most galling of all was a rout in the only theater of war they had previously won a substantial victory, North Africa. And here in North Africa, the Allies are being pushed all across North Africa. Here the British could generally count on strong superiority on the ground and in the air. But their plans to clear the southern shore of the Mediterranean were foiled again and again by the German Panzer Army and by Erwin Rommel, the Desert Fox. Rommel was a master of armored warfare who knew how to keep his tanks concentrated for a decisive blow while the British fed theirs piecemeal into battle only to be chewed up by the German tanks. On a single day in mid-June, Rommel destroyed or captured 230 tanks around a crossroads that was called Knightsbridge. By early July, he had swept the British out of Libya and driven 240 miles into Egypt. Axis propaganda proclaimed Rommel invincible. Mussolini was so sure of victory, he ordered a white horse ready for a triumphant entry into Alexandria. This is late summer of 1942. On the full moon of October 23rd, nearly 1,000 Allied guns opened upon the enemy batteries for 20 minutes and then turned on to their infantry positions. Under this concentration of fire, deepened by bombing from the air, the 30th and the 13th Corps of the British Army advance. Rommel, incidentally, had gone to hospital in Germany in September. The dates are all important. And his place was taken by General Stumm. Within 24 hours of the Allied counterattack at El Alamein, within 24 hours of the start of the battle, Stumm died of a heart attack. Rommel, at Hitler's request, left hospital and resumed his command late on the 25th of October, 42. The battle at El Alamein raged for days. At 1 a.m. on November 2nd, supercharged, the main attack began. And then came on the 3rd of November an order from Hitler, the Marschallmacht, forbidding any retreat. But the issue was no longer in German hands. Only one more hole had to be punched in the German lines. Very, very early on November 4th, 5 miles south of Tel El Aquiri, the 5th Indian Brigade launched a quickly mounted attack which was successful. The battle was now won, and the way finally cleared for British armor to pursue across the open desert. Rommel was in full retreat. Incidentally, it took 4 months for the Allies to push Rommel across North Africa, 1,590 miles. The Battle of El Alamein will ever make a glorious page in British military annals. It marked the turning point of the hinge of fate. It may almost be said, and these are the words of Churchill, "Before El Alamein, we never had a victory. After El Alamein, we never had a defeat." All right? We now have the dates of the struggle for El Alamein. Maybe just as an aside, not completely along the lines of our book, there's a very powerful, beautiful book that has been forgotten. The name of the book is The Forgotten Ally by Pierre Van Passen. It was written in 1943. Pierre Van Passen writes about the forgotten ally of the war. Who was it that really assisted the Allies? And he describes 45 days in June and half of July 1942. A group of 500 Palestinians. Do I have to tell you who Palestinians were in 1942? 500 Palestinian Jews who had volunteered for special service in the British Army under the command of a Major Liebman were given an area before El Alamein to sow it with mines. For 45 days, the German Army armor tanks pounded the 500 Jews. By the first week in July, there were 45 left out of 500. And remember, for 5 weeks now, 500 Jews have been holding Rommel right there in the desert. 5 weeks, 500 Jews. Meanwhile, England is bringing in supplies from all over the world. Toward the end, the last day of the battle, the 45 are already less. A number in the heat had run off into the desert, had gone mad. And finally, I see a column of jeeps coming toward their encampment. A general, a French general, Free French, had come to relieve what were left of the remnants of the Palestinian Jews. General Koenig, Pierre Koenig, commander of the French forces. He salutes Major Liebman, "You held out. 45 days you held out." And he sees how Major Liebman is holding something in his hand, and he asks him, "What is it that you're holding in your hand?" So he says, "It's the Jewish flag, the Star of David, but we're not permitted, by British law, we're not permitted to fly the flag." So he, General Koenig says, that flag is going to go on my front jeep. He turns to his soldiers and he says, Le drapeau juif, salute. The Jewish flag, salute. For 45 days, 500 Jews, the forgotten ally, held Rommel at bay before El Alamein. Only an aside fits. What was taking place in Eretz Yisrael? What was taking place in Eretz Yisrael? Through all of 42. And this is going to be important for later aspects of our discussion. The real question that we have to ask about the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael, what was their condition and their situation with 400 Jews in Eretz Yisrael in 1942? 400,000 Jews. When Rommel was at El Alamein, they estimate that a third of the population, the Jewish population of Eretz Yisrael, were walking around with poison pills in their pockets. Everybody assumed that Rommel was going to break through at El Alamein to Alexandria. The High Commissioner had already told Yitzhak Ben Zvi that the decision has been taken in London that in the event that Rommel breaks through at El Alamein, the British Army has orders to evacuate the entire Middle East. Eretz Yisrael is going to be left without protection at all. Finished. It's all over. Those who would flee would flee. Those who would commit suicide would commit suicide. And those who would go off into the mountains to fight would fight. The real question, and this is going to be very important, what did the Yishuv know, what did Eretz Yisrael know about European Jewry and when during 1942? At the beginning of 1942, there was a letter sent by Molotov about Nazi atrocities and included brief descriptions of special cruelty toward Jews. Early 42. There were unconfirmed reports of cruelty toward Jews. There were reports that had come from London about Jews being taken out into forests and killed in eastern Poland. January and February of 1942, the press in Eretz Yisrael published reports of deaths of Jews in Warsaw, diminishing of Ghetto Lodz and Vilna by tens of thousands. There were reports, unconfirmed reports, of the murder of children and aged in Russia, deportation from Czechoslovakia, unconfirmed reports of poison gas used on 400 Jews in Holland. In February 42, the Struma sinks in the Black Sea despite repeated efforts to get the British to allow them to enter Eretz Yisrael. 770 died. 70 of them were children. Pictures of the boat, the Struma, with the sign Save Us, shocked the Yishuv at Eretz Yisrael. There were all sorts of demonstrations against the British government. By the middle of March, representatives of the joint in Hungary, who returned to America, reported that Hungarian soldiers returning from the front spoke of 250,000 Jews killed by the Gestapo in the Ukraine. There were also reports of 100,000 Jews that had been killed in the conquered areas of Russia. The flow of information, all unconfirmed, came during the March, April, May. In May, there was a report of 90,000 Jews killed in Minsk. There was talk of the destruction of the Jews in Estonia. Ghetto Kovno erupted in battle. At the highest level of the Jewish agency here in Eretz Yisrael, at the end of June, at the beginning of July of 42, they had not yet dealt in any serious way with any of these reports. They knew about them, they were mentioned, but nobody really dealt with them. And here it's extremely important to know one point. And I want to read this from a, why was nothing serious going on in Eretz Yisrael during the course of the months of June and July. During the course of the months of June and July, and August and September, and October and November of 1942, a great deal. There are many accusations against the Jewish Agency that they simply abandoned European Jewry. We're going to talk about that later, because that's also important. דווקא בחודשים שאחרי פרסום הידיעות על השמדה שיטתית באירופה. It just happened that in those months after the first reports of what seemed to be planned atrocity against Jews, it was precisely at that time that the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael found itself in a position that lo hu alta klal she'ilat yecholto la'atzil et Yehudei Eropa. They didn't deal at all with the question of saving the Jews of Europe. Ela she'ilat yecholto hu li'yishe'er b'chayim. What concerned the Yishuv then was, would they survive? They were not in a position to do anything for European Jewry. Rommel, precisely at that moment, was at the gates of Alexandria. England is ready to evacuate and abandon the entire Middle East. This was not a time at which the Yishuv was in any way prepared to deal with the problem of Jews of Europe. They don't know if they're going to survive another month. We'll come back to more quotations. The most important thing is August, the middle of August of 1942, the first confirmed report in the world, but a confirmed report not merely of atrocities against Jews, a confirmed report that there is a German plan to destroy all of European Jewry. Not until August of 1942 was there any report that could be taken seriously that there is a plan to annihilate. Up until then, yes, there were atrocities, and more there are atrocities. But a plan to destroy all of European Jewry, August. September was a busy month in Eretz Yisrael. They were trying to find out, the entire Jewish community in the world is trying to find out, is this true? Is this really what's happening? In October, they find out that it's true. There is a plan to destroy and annihilate all of European Jewry. And at the end of October and early November, a rout of Rommel at El Alamein. What does the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael do? The Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael calls for 3 days of Eivel, Mecha'ah, and Za'aka against the British government. They demand of Britain, and this was across the board, Flummer, Freyer, everybody, 3 days of Eivel, general strike throughout the country against the British. You have to open up the doors of Eretz Yisrael. We know that millions of Jews are now slated for death. Let me ask you, was that a time for Eretz Yisrael to make a simcha? Was that a time for Eretz Yisrael to make a holiday? El Alamein! We were saved from Mavet Machayim. Wouldn't it have been the most grotesque simcha of all? The Yishuv, Klal Yisrael, conducted itself the way Jews should conduct themselves. Yes, the threat to Eretz Yisrael has been averted. Rommel is being thrown back across North Africa. But millions of Jews are besakonas nefoshes. Was that the time to make a simcha? El Alamein? That's a question. And El Alamein is used, therefore, to trivialize Yom HaTzmaut because if we didn't make a Yom Tov for El Alamein, we'd be making a Yom Tov for Yom HaTzmaut. Yom HaTzmaut is, if anything, Yom HaTzmaut was the beginning of a war. I have dealt with El Alamein at length for a number of reasons. I want to repeat that. El Alamein and days similar to it are used as the means to demonstrate the relative unimportance of Yom HaAtzmaut. It is also, in our further discussion, going to be important to know the situation of the Yishuv, what was going on in Eretz Yisrael at the time. It is also, in our further discussion, going to be important to know the situation of the Yishuv, what was going on in Eretz Yisrael at the time. Because as I said, until today, the attack on the 400,000 Jews in Eretz Yisrael and the secular leadership over here, as though they had abandoned, Jewry in Europe for their own reasons, because what is it, the ugly quote, that I don't think anybody has ever been able to prove, that a cow in Eretz Yisrael, I can't even say it, you know, is worth more. Ugly. This was not the the Yishuv found itself in its own dire straits. And when they could, we're going to demonstrate precisely how they did indeed conduct themselves. But now you'll have to wait. During those months, Dina Porat, Hanhagab B'Milkud, a study of all of the documents of the Jewish Agency, all the meetings that took place during the war, in order to see how did they act, react, or not react in the face of the destruction of European Jewry. I will, at a later point, quote more from this. She says that at one point it appears in the in one of the letters, Ben Gurion hit nadneid ben tikvali yush. In these terrible months, Ben Gurion was constantly moving between hope and despair, and he said to the Vav Hakoel Hatzioni, Mi sheinenu ro'eh bifnei ma hayahadut omeret achshav hu iver. Anybody who does not see what Jewry is now faced with is blind. Veinenu Yehudi, Veinenu Adam, is neither Jew nor man. Yecholim Yitzorach et Kulam, they may kill them all. Einenu Yodea im Yisharu Yehudim acharei Hitler. I don't know if any Jews are really left after Hitler. All right. I believe that that's enough on the question of El Alamein. A few words about the tzvira, the siren, versus the saying of Tehillim. And the body of what I have to say with regard to Yom HaAtzmaut will come after this. What I'm going to tell you about the tzvira is a personal view. It's quite subjective. Take it as you wish. As I said, you don't have to accept my opinion. Shimudati, just listen. I want to describe my feelings during the first Tzvira experience. I, of course, do not believe, and this Rabbi said, there are opinions who hold that it is not Chukat HaGoy. Chukat HaGoy is only in the event that something that a Goy does that has overtones of Avodah Zarah, but otherwise there are Chochma Bagoyim Yesh, there are wise things that are done by the nation of the world too. They're not all stupid. There is wisdom. So therefore, I don't hold that it's Kukdas Hagoy, and anything that is not L'shem Avodah Zarah and has a rational reason does not fall under the Yisra of Kukdas Hagoy. I want to describe my first experience. It must have been 8, 9, 10 years ago. I'm standing of all places. I was on the middle of Rehov Yafo. The siren goes off. Everything stops. There was a feeling of unease. I didn't know what to do with myself. I'm standing there, like, a little strange, a little funny. Time was moving, but there are moments at which time moves so slowly. like, when will this be over? Then imperceptibly, I started thinking about all the people that I saw on the street. I started thinking about a whole country in which there may be a few million people who at this precise moment are standing silently. I began to look at the people around me. I began to think, how many of them had lost a loved one in the defense of this country? How many had lost a loved one in the Shoah? There may be somebody standing next to me who lost a son, a daughter, a husband, a wife. And the siren is still going. It may be no more than 1 minute into the siren. How many people around me carried for a lifetime the ache of such a final loss? How many of them had made it now part of their lives? Graves and grave sites. How many unfinished lives so that others may live? It may have been into the second minute of the Tzirah and I was getting choked up. And then abruptly, it was over. I kept standing there. That's what it means. One can say all of Tilim 100 times and not feel 1 second the pain of the loss of a loved one, so that we should be able to learn and live and produce and do things here. Tilim is not in place of Tzvihah. Tilim is certainly not going to help for people who are not ready to say the Mishaberach L'chai Alei Sahal on Shabbos. We're talking here about a feeling, an experience. How many of us have felt the pain of the Shoah? How many classic moments do we have? There are seconds in our lives at which we can say that I felt that for a moment to show up. It may have been a film, it may have been a book, it may have been something. Tilim is Tilim, and I love Tilim, and I say Tilim. But we're talking about a very special experience. There's a Chov Kadosh on a Jew to remember and to feel. To go through a whole lifetime and not have felt a moment's pain. An ache. For Chalalei HaShoah or Chalalei Ma'arkot Yisrael, I would use the words of Ben Gurion. Einenu Yehudi ve'einenu Adam. One does not take the place of the other. Thank God I say Tilim regularly. It's powerful, it's gewaltig. Tekiat Shofar. What does the Rambam say? The Rambam tells us all the things we're supposed to think during those moments, the seconds of Tekiat Shofar. There's a feeling that's supposed to overcome us. To reject the nonsense of life, to turn to God, tshuva, honesty, sincerity, change the way of our lives. A sound is going, but the sound of the shofar silences all others, and I'm able to maybe for 1 second think clearly. That was the personal subjective experience that I've had at the Tzvira. And as far as I'm concerned, if I had 2 seconds of feeling, it was worth it. I mean, it's not a question. Indoors, no. But I don't have to. I go about my business. Outdoors, I don't make a chil Hashem. Or maybe to demonstrate a phony achdus, you know, everybody's standing, I'll stand. There's a purpose. There's a point to it. And a powerful one. There's only one problem. The source from whence it came. Who decided on the Tzvirah? The Knesset. That is going to be the issue that surrounds all of Yom HaAtzmaut. And surrounds the entire establishment of the state. That's going to be the broader and the greater issue that a part of our religious world has simply not been able to come to grips with. That all of this was done by Mechalei Shabbos and Ochlei Tzeifus and Nachmanen Itzlan, all sorts of terrible things. This is a difficulty, and I understand the difficulty. for 50 years before the establishment of the state, the religious establishment, the majority of the religious establishment fought it tooth and nail. It was only at the Knesset Gadol, I believe, in 1937, where there was a tremendous struggle that took place there. The final decision of Agudas Yisrael was that we're going for the establishment of the state. We're going to back it. Obviously, Yom HaTzmaut creates difficulties, extreme difficulties. These people whom we fought for 50 years succeeded in accomplishing what no other country in the world accomplished in the 20th century. The two greatest accomplishments of the 20th century were the establishment of the State of Israel and the rebirth of Torah in Eretz Yisrael and in the world. I see them, you can put them in any order you want. The rebirth of Torah in Eretz Yisrael, the establishment of a Jewish state. These were the two great accomplishments of the 20th century. The tragedy of it all is 42 years later, neither one of the two recognizes the other or appreciates the other. There is a famous word from the Brisker Rav. The Brisker Rav said, at the turn of the century, the Russians built the Trans-Siberian Railway. I don't know how many thousands of Russians died laying those tracks, I don't know where, from the Ukraine to Vladivostok. They died in the snows of Siberia. So the Brisker Rav said, and the Russians thought that all of those lives were being lost so that Russia, Mother Russia, should be able to cross from Europe through the steppes of Central Asia across the Urals to Vladivostok, said the Brisker Rav. No, this was Yad HaShgacha. So that when B'nai Torah from the Mir would have to flee from Lithuania, they get onto the Trans-Siberian Railway that would take them to safety to Vladivostok. I take the Brisker Rav a step further. The most powerful movement in this century that has turned the world upside down and is turning it upside down before our very eyes right now is nationalism. An imam in Bemuna Shleima that the Rebbeinu Shlom did not bring down the idea of nationalism on the face of this earth because he wanted Chad or Zimbabwe or Sri Lanka or who knows how many other countries on the face of this earth. All of nationalism during the course of this century was so that at one moment of chesed, a world could realize that also Eretz Yisrael, Klal Yisrael also needs a land. He did not create nationalism so that we should have all of these third, fourth world countries that are no more than terrible dictatorships and are destructive. It was all for one purpose. If the Trans-Siberian Railway could be for the Miri Yeshiva, then I believe a world in collision and upheaval in the 20th century was so that Klal Yisrael should begin the process of returning home. I want to conclude with, may take me 10 minutes, is that okay? 10, maybe 15 minutes, so that this will be the introduction to what is going to come later. I had the privilege of being after Purim. This year I was in Toronto. I was there for a family simcha. But what added to the uniqueness of the experience was the fact that I was able to meet again a Rebbe of mine, and you know, there reaches a point in life when you're able to talk about 40 years ago. A Rebbe of mine 40 years ago in Karvadas, whom I had great love and affection for, who had a tremendous impact on me, and who is now one of the members, I would say president of the Mietzes Gedolei HaTorah in the United States, of Avram Kahn, the Rashiva of Karvadas. He was in Toronto for a family simcha as well, and I went to see him, say hello to him, and he spoke. I'm going to tell you over the kitzur what he said. And this will be the background on the basis of which we will continue Mitzvah Hashem next week on the entire area of Yom HaAtzma'ut, Hakamat HaMedina, and how I look at it 42 years later. Incidentally, just as another aside, I come by all of this honestly. My father, Olav Shalom, was Nifter in Eretz Yisrael in 1981. We were here on sabbatical. And after he died, I went through the few papers that he had left and I found a letter that I had never known existed. The letter was from the Jewish Agency for Palestine, and it was dated, I believe, August 6, 1942. The 1946. 46. But since there are no certificates available at the present time, we look forward with hope and prayer to the day that all Jews will be able to come to Eretz Yisrael freely. And when one hears the news this morning that 1,100,000 Russian Jews have signed up for Aliyah, that was 7 o'clock news, 1,100,000, the significance of that will be discussed next week as well. Extremely important. And those Jews are coming here bizfoot one day and one day alone. Yom HaAtzma'ut. Not because of El Aladein. Because of Yom HaAtzma'ut. When the proclamation was made that all Jews in the world who want to are free to come to Eretz Yisrael. And Mr. and Mrs. Gold and the three children will also be able to come to Eretz Yisrael. I come by my religious Zionism, mi beten umi leida. But I went through periods of time where I was on the other side and I brought myself back. I want to tell you now the idea that was expressed by Avraham, and we continue in Yitzhak Hashem next week. There's a pasuk in Parashat Eged that says, V'yodata im levavecha, know it with your heart, ki kasher yaser ish et beno, as a father punishes and chastises a son, kein Hashem elokecha miyasrecha, so God chastises and punishes you. When there are times when God has to bring suffering and punishment, but when he brings it like a father. Says Rav Pan, there is a corollary to this passage. Since God is a father, what does a father do after he brings punishment? You know what a father does? He pours out love to the child in order to regain his love, to rebuild the relationship that existed between them. An outpouring of love, affection, kindness, and goodness. He said that corollary is a law in Jewish history. Following every period of profound suffering came a period of at which God opens up the very gates of heaven and pours out his kindness upon the Jewish people. And each one of those periods is a period at which it's possible for Moshiach to come. He gave three examples plus one. Example number one. In the days of Chizkiyahu Melech Yehuda. In the days of Chizkiyahu Melech Yehuda, Klal Yisrael had reached one of the lowest points in its history. The 10 tribes had already been sent into exile by the forces of Asher. You know what that means, 10 tribes, 10 out of 12? A Klal Yisrael that was like this is now down to one-fifth of its size. How many? 5, 10 million are sent into exile. All of Eretz Yehuda has already been conquered, and Sanherev has already arrived someplace in the neighborhood of Neve Yaakov, and he looks down on Givat Yerushalayim and he waves his hand and he says, tomorrow we destroy Yerushalayim. We're talking now a moment before the end of the Jewish people. That night, the angel of God comes down and destroys the forces of Sanherev. And the Gemara says that Chizkiyahu could have been Moshiach. Because after a period of such suffering where Klal Yisrael was nearly decimated, annihilated, exterminated, only a small number of Jews relative to the size of Klal Yisrael remained, and only Yerushalayim and its suburbs. At that moment, God opens up the gates of heaven and pours out Chesed v'Racham, Itorut milamala. And Chizkiyahu could have been Moshiach, but there were problems. And because of those problems, Moshiach didn't come. Chizkiyahu was not Moshiach. And this we can see from the words of Rashi and the Malbim at the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph in Yeshayahu. Perek Yud is the one that describes Nebuchadnezzar looking down upon Yerushalayim, and Yud Aleph is the great chapter that talks about the coming of the Moshiach. It could have been, but aborted. We don't know why. The second period in Jewish history was the period of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva made no mistake when he thought that Bar Kokhba was Moshiach. Klal Yisrael had been suffering under Rome for 100 years. It couldn't go on any longer. Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Jews were suffering. Rabbi Akiva, with the vision of a Rabbi Akiva, knew in his neshama that the time is ripe for the coming of Moshiach. Aram says, Rabbi Akiva and Kol Bnei Doro, all the people of his generation, felt that Bar Kokhba was going to be Moshiach. Did Rabbi Akiva make a mistake? No, he didn't make a mistake. But Aram says that was Shegora Machet. It was a sin, for whatever reason it was. We don't know what it was. But it just didn't happen then. But why did Rabbi Akiva think that this is a period that is ready for the period of Moshiach? Because after such awesome and frightening suffering, God opens up the gates of heaven. The third period was the period of the Chachmei HaKabbalah in Tzfat. Rav Shlomo Alkavitz, you know Rav Shlomo Alkavitz? The one who wrote Lecha Dodi? What do you think Lecha Dodi is all about? Lecha Dodi, they are in Tzfat and they're looking down to Migdash Melech, Ir Melucha, the holy city, the city of the kingdom, Kumi Tzi'i, Mitocha, Afecha, rise out of the rubble and the ruin. Ravlach Shevet Be'emekadoch, it's enough! You're sitting in the valley of tears, Behu Yachamol, God is going to have great mercy, Olayach Emla, Hitnari, get the dust off. May offer to me, arise in the dust. Livshi big day tifarte hamin, put on the garments of the beauty of my people. Ayav ben Yishai, beit halachmi, because ben Yishai, beit halachmi, Mashiach is cooling his heels and ready to come. Korvo el nafshi do'ola, I feel it. What was it that was so special about that time? The Chachmei HaKabbalah in Tzfat in the 16th century, this was immediately after Girush Sfarad, this was immediately after the expulsion of Jews from Spain. The Jewish community of Spain was the Torah of the world. Hundreds of thousands, if not more, Jews were simply wandering through a world looking for some place to set down roots. It was an upheaval in the Jewish world of awesome and frightening proportions. A Jewish world was left without a center, without leadership, without anything. Of all things, at precisely that time, Chachmei Eretz Yisrael joined together for the first and up until now the last time in history to give smicha to a number of people. What kind of smicha? According to the Rambam, there's a halacha that if Chachmei Eretz Yisrael joined together and give smicha, ordination, to a number of people, those people get an ordination which has the power of the ordination, the smicha of Moshe Rabbeinu, and they are able to be members of the Sanhedrin. It was done that time. Rabbi Yosef Karo, the Mechaber of the Shulchan Aruch, received smicha. Why did they get together at that time, and how did they get together? Jointly, together, in order to give smicha. You know why? Because they felt ot. They felt the footsteps of Ben Yishai Beit Halachmi. They felt Korva El Nafshi Gola. After such suffering, after such a terrible, terrible destruction of Jewish communities out the world, it's now the time for Mashiach. And therefore, they renewed smicha. Therefore, they felt geula in the air. It was aborted. It didn't happen. Rav Palm concluded by saying the obvious. In our time, the Holocaust, clearly the worst period of suffering of any people in all of history. What must naturally follow? What must naturally follow is that the Rebbeinu Shlalom opens up the very gates of heaven and pours out chesed, v'rachamim, goodness and kindness, and gives Klal Yisrael every opportunity to be reborn and rejuvenated and grow. And he was not even afraid of saying that, he quoted the Chafetz Chaim, that in 1917 when the Balfour Declaration was announced, the Chafetz Chaim said that, oh, this is a sign that something, big things are about to happen. If Umos HaOlam see that Klal Yisrael deserve a homeland in Eretz Yisrael, yes, a homeland. And the gates of Rachamim have been open now for 42 years. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu is pouring out that greatness and that kindness on this land. The question always is, what are we going to do with it? What are we going to do with it? Are we going to turn it into something that will be lasting? Or God forbid, I believe it will be lasting. Or God forbid, are we going to blow the opportunity? What's taking place over here, before our very eyes for the last 42 years, starting on Yom HaTzmaut, what we're talking about is an outpouring of Ma'aseh Hashem. And am I supposed to believe that the Shoah is Ritzon Hashem, and Hakamat Medinat Yisrael is not? It's blasphemous! Of course HaKamat Medinat Yisrael is Ritzon Hashem. That's real Ritzon Hashem. That's a father pouring out his love and his kindness and his goodness. He wants it. It's against him. This is Ma'aseh Sodom, this is the Sifra Akra, this is the Nisayon. What are you talking about? Can we be blinded from seeing the goodness of God while at the same time we know all of the reasons for suffering that we know, but we can't see his chesed? Of course it's chesed. Of course this is divine. Why God chooses to bring the outpouring of love, chesed, and rachamim through people who are mechallel Shabbos? I don't know. I may know by next week. The truth is, I do know this week. But God has a right to choose whomever he feels will be able to do what it is that has to be done. And that's what I was saying. I said before that the two great accomplishments of the 20th century were the establishment of the State of Israel and the rebirth and rejuvenation of Torah in Eretz Yisrael. And the Rebbeinu, you know what he does? He gives out jobs to the ones that can do it. Ben Gurion didn't have to learn Daf Yomi. I think Ben Gurion was better off trying to establish a state. It's our job to infuse this country with Ruchnius, and it was their job to establish the framework within which this Ruchnius can grow. But if our attitude toward that other segment of the population is going to be a negative one, then we're not going to infuse anybody with Ruchnius. There are two partners in the establishment of this great undertaking. God has thrown the secular and the religious Jew into one boat. That's where he put us in history, because he wants us to learn to live together, and each one has a task to do. And if our approach is going to be a negative one, one that trivializes, we're never going to accomplish what we are here to accomplish. In Yet Hashem next week, we're going to start citing sources. Das Gedolei Torah. We're going to deal with all of these issues. Today was introduction.